Salvi drills it to deep left field, and he gets it into the Crawford boxes, making this a grinding inning every inning, and now the Royals are going to get a big inning. Taylor scores, Rivera scores, Witt is digging for third, and he's going to be in there with a two-run triple.
Royals win again. Break up the Royals. Welcome to the Sports Ticket. Wade and Dusty with you. The Royals have won four in a row. They have now won seven of the last eight, four of their last five against the first-place Astros. And for the first time since 2017, the Royals win the season series against the Astros, who are in first place in their division. But if they keep playing the Royals, they won't be. And once again, the Royals win a matchup against a former Royals at Greinke, as Daniel Lynch did a wonderful job once again. The Royals with a whole bunch of hits, able to score seven runs. It was 2-1 game, and Royals with insurance late, as you heard. Salvador Perez, his 33rd homer, 81 RBIs, a new career high. Whit Merrifield, a two-run triple in the eighth to give them insurance to push the lead to 7-1. Mike Matheny, pleased with his offense's approach against Greinke.
Are guys going to try and get big, or are they going to just stay with a good short approach and realize this guy can throw anything in any count and has a real nice idea where he's trying to put it? And be able to make a mark early. Rivera having a real nice day for us. Same deal, though. Wasn't trying to get Poole happy. Wasn't thinking about the Crawford boxes. He was thinking about taking barrel to the ball. And, uses the opposite field and gets something going. Salvi being Salvi. And then just all the way through there, Witt having a big day again. And guys taking good at-bats, making some good plays.
Offensively, Whit Merrifield with three hits, three RBIs. You heard the two-run triple. Salvi, 2-for-3. And believe it or not, he walked twice, which is shocking. And also, Emmanuel Rivera at third base with three hits and two runs scored, two RBIs. And Zach Greinke takes the loss. He's now 11-4 on the season. Daniel Lynch, another fine performance. Five innings, six hits, one run, three walks, five Ks. He wasn't brilliant, but he was good enough. And then Tapia, that they picked up in that trade for cash with the Mariners, that's worked out pretty good. He's been a good setup guy. Lovelady, Zimmer, and Santana were able to close it out, and the Royals win it 7-1. They bang out 13 hits. They're now 56-68 on the year. Astros fall to 73-52. Royals will be back in action tonight at 7:10. Brady Singer on the hill for the Royals. He is 3-8 with ERA of 5.32. And I was talking yesterday while you were gone about the Royals. You start looking at this rotation, I'm cautiously optimistic. I know a lot of people getting excited, and I say, well, September's just about here, so that's when the Royals start to take off. And then we get all excited, and we go into spring training, and then we get ready for the opening day, and this is the year we're going to be really good. And then starting pitching isn't good, or the offense can't score. But when you do look at this team going in the next year, there have been some really good signs. Carlos Hernandez's last three starts, he's been the seventh inning every one of them. His last start was fantastic. He's only 24. Daniel Lynch has been consistent since he's come up from AAA, his last four or five starts. There's a guy that's 24. Brady Singer's last start was really good. Singer's only 23, I believe it is. He's young. Chris Bubich's last start, he had a no-hitter through six innings. His previous start, worst of his career. I don't think Bubich is a long-term starter in this rotation, but he's a guy that could be a piece of the puzzle pitching-wise, maybe in the bullpen or spot starter in the future. And you look at those guys, and then Keller's pitched better recently. He's been an enigma this year. Mike Minor, I believe they have him for one more year. Is that right? Was that a 1 or 2 year deal?
I
thought it was a 2 year deal, but I might
think it's one more year.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So they would have him to piece in somewhere next year if they need to. Jackson Cower, they like down in the minors. Of course, he had a cup of tea at the big league level. So the Royals have a few options here when it comes to their rotation in the future. The key is the development, and that's something we haven't seen the Royals do, is develop young pitchers into bona fide frontline starters. Lynch might be one of those guys. Hernandez might be one of those guys. And then you've got Singer, and you've got Bubich, and those four, along with Keller, in fact, all five, have pitched well as of recently in their last start or multiple starts. So I need a bigger sample size for me to get really super excited about it, because I know that hitters it adjust. And hitters watch a lot of film, and they will make adjustments. And I think you saw that this year against Brady Singer, who's really struggled. And also, Keller, Singer, all these guys have to have three pitches. Singer tried to live off of two early in the year, didn't work last game. He threw his changeup a little bit more. What do you know? He had more success. Keller, He basically can get through the lineup two times and struggles a third time through, but if he can have three pitches, he's got a better chance of going deeper in games. He's only 25, 26 years of age. So the future is bright for the rotation. But then, Dusty, when you look at the position players, I don't know what they're going to do with Bobby Witt Jr., if they're going to bring him up in September or not. I don't think they really need to, but they could. Where does Witt Jr. fit if he makes this team on opening day next year? I think he will. Where does Nick Prado fit? Prado's easy because Prado will be the first baseman when he's ready. And Carlos Santana is just holding it down. And Santana will be with the Royals again next year. And I think by the All-Star break next year, Prado will be on this team if he continues to develop and hit well at AAA, that he'll be your first baseman come middle of next season. And then you can trade Carlos Santana and get something for him possibly. But where does Bobby Witt Jr. fit in the picture? And I keep coming back to now the Royals have three bona fide shortstops.
Yeah.
You've got Mondesi, who's hurt. Nicky Lopez has played very well at short. What do you do if Bobby Witt Jr. is ready on opening day next year? Are you playing him at third base, hoping that Mondesi's healthy? Do you just say, the heck with that? If he's ready to go, he's our shortstop, and you try to find another place for Mondesi, whether you trade him, which you won't get much right now, or you move him to the outfield. What do you do with Hunter Dozier? If Witt Jr. goes to third and Mondesi's healthy and at short, then what do you do with Dozier? Does he play first? No, he can't. His Santana's there. So he DHs. That would make most sense. What do you do with Nicky Lopez? He's had a really good year. Do you move Lopez to second? If Mondesi's healthy, you probably move Lopez to second. Well, that means you jerk Witt back to the outfield, and you keep jerking Witt. One year he's outfield, and then he's second base, and he starts in outfield, and he's second base. And so, you know, it doesn't seem to phase Witt, but Witt's not a spring chicken anymore. I mean, he came up in the bigs at the age of 27. You know, playing in the outfield is harder on your legs sometimes, they say. So, you know, does Witt end up being your right fielder next year? Or does he play center field? Probably not. I think Taylor would be. But was Taylor a one-year deal? Taylor was a one-year deal,
I'm pretty sure he was one.
Yeah.
I'm going to look that up once my restarted computer boots back up.
I don't know. I don't know what the Royals' plan will be. Benintendi looks to be your left fielder. Right field, you know, you could easily have Witt out there. Center field, when you're looking at the Royals and what you're going to do, is a question mark right now, because Michael Taylor will be gone unless they re-sign him. You know, I don't really want Dozier in right, Witt in center. I don't like that combination defensively. So there's so many things that are predicated on what do they do with Mondesi. It ain't really about what they do with Witt Jr. He can either play short or third. They'll find a spot for him. The question is, what Mondesi is the moving piece in this equation. He is, like, if he can be like he's capable of being, he is a five-tool player. He is him and Witt Jr. would be the two most athletic players on this team. And if you had Mondesi at short and Witt at third and they stay healthy, man, I like the future for the Royals. And then Lopez is shown to be a really guy that can put the ball in play. He can bunt, he can steal, he plays outstanding defense, even at shortstop. You got him at second. And the other thing, too, is if Mondesi get hurt again, you could slide Nicky Lopez back to short and then Witt back to second, and you just keep Witt at third. You don't mess with Bobby Witt moving him back between short and third. So I know that's a long way off, but it is kind of interesting to look at the future. And then the other thing is MJ Melendez is tearing it up in AA and AAA, and he's a catcher. Well, there's a guy called Salvi that's blocking him, and Salvi ain't going to be a DH, especially if Dozier's going to be a DH. So then what do you do with Melendez if he's ready? Maybe he's your right fielder. Strong arm, catchers can be in, you know. It's a good problem to have. We haven't had a problem like this in a while. It's a good problem to have with some guys that are really starting to, you know, have been tearing it up offensively, Melendez, Prado, and Witt Jr. And the question then is, when do you want to start their service time? But I still say those guys are all great and all. You know, Mondesi gets healthy. If you got Dozier in the lineup as a DH all the time, and Prado's ready at first, and Witt Jr. plays third, and Witt goes the outfield, and Lopez is at second. Okay, that's a pretty good lineup. And Benintendi in left, Salvi behind the plate. But it still comes down to whether these young pitchers, that's the whole key for me. Mm-hmm. Witt Jr. and Mondesi, all these guys, they could be healthy, hit 25 homers each and drive in 100 runs. And we've seen Royals teams that have had great offenses see Carlos Beltran, Jermaine Dye, and Johnny Damon, and they couldn't get anybody out. And hitters can't get guys out. So I think everything hinges still on what this young Royals rotation could look like. Right now, you got to say you think Hernandez and Lynch at this very moment in time are guys that could be there for a while. Singer, I still think the jury's out on him. So I think you've got two-fifths of the equation maybe figured out, but it's a short sample size. And then Mike Minor could be a fourth or fifth starter if you're waiting for a young guy to develop. But then the question marks I would have, believe it or not, I have more questions about Brady Singer and Brad Keller than I do Daniel Lynch and Carlos Hernandez right now. And then granted, a month from now, they start struggling. Then you say, oh, God, what's wrong with the Royals' rotation? We're doomed again. That's why I'm not getting too excited, but I can see the optimism that people may have for the Royals, rightfully so.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, Minor was a two-year deal and third-year option for $13 million they won't take, but he'll be
a part of it next year.
But, yeah. Those are all questions. And from what I understand, like, they really don't want to have to move Melendez from catcher, too, right? Like, he's a really good prospect at his position.
Right.
But with Salvi there, it's like, well, how do you want to handle that then, right? And so, yeah, that's a tough one. But, yeah, I mean, you got to have the rotation going. You got to have a good staff there before you can start relying on everybody else that you think is probably going to be the future of this team in the field and at the plate, right? And so you've got to have it going. I mean, it's all got to be clicking for you to have success.
If you get to the point where you believe Melendez is ready to be your catcher, and you go, Salvi, you convince him to, hey, man, that's a length in your career, and you'll be a DH. Because you don't need first.
Yeah.
Because Prado can play first, I think. You'll be fine. As long as he can hit. So, Salvi goes to DH. Where does Hunter Dozier go? They just signed him to a long-term deal last offseason, and he hasn't performed, by the way. So, I think Dozier, honestly, would probably go back to the outfield and right field. Now, where does Witt go? I think that'd be center. There's no other place for Witt.
Yeah.
And I don't know about Witt in center field with his age and stuff, but not to say he can't do it, but for a full season. Because Lopez, to me, there's only two places he can play, second and short. He's not playing outfield.
Yeah.
Mondesi, I think, could be an outstanding center fielder with his speed and everything else. Mm. But with all his problems with obliques and strains and this and that, I don't know if you want – well, he's just made out of glass right now. It doesn't matter where
you
put him.
Well, that's the thing, too, is, like, we're doing all this banking on Mondesi actually being healthy.
That's what,
right?
I'm saying. I'm not banking on it. I'm saying
or
if
we're
he is.
Not banking, but we're – trying to put this together based on Mondesi being healthy, right? And so, man, right now it doesn't even look like you're going to have to worry about Mondesi factoring in if he can't get healthy and stay healthy.
Listen, to me, this is easy. This is easy. Let's just go ahead and do the other scenario. Mondesi isn't healthy. Simple. Witt's your shortstop, Bobby Witt Jr.
Yeah.
Second baseman's Lopez. Witt Merrifield goes back to the outfield. And Dozier's your third baseman.
Third, yeah.
And in your DH, you'll find a DH one way or the other. Or Salvi, maybe Melendez does come up and he catches and Salvi does DH. I don't think they'll probably do it that quickly, but that there's a, you can always find a guy to DH. That's not a problem. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that would be the scenario. That would honestly, Mondesi not being healthy and not playing next year would make it easier to figure out who goes where. But for this team to really reach its ultimate potential, how do you not want a guy, if he is healthy, a five-tool player, not to play?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Mondesi, we saw in 10 games, he had four home runs and his defense is spectacular. The problem is he's only played 10 games.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting, and it's a good problem to have.
Well, yeah, you don't complain about it. You have multiple guys that can play in different spots. I mean, that's never a problem.
Nicky Lopez has done better at short than I thought he would, I have to admit.
Yeah. And he's the bats picked up, too.
He's hit better than I thought he would, too. Yeah, outstanding. All right, the Royals in action again tonight against the Astros, Singer on the hill. Coming up, the latest news from Pac-12 on expansion, how it affects the Big 12, a big announcement by college football coming out this afternoon, we've been told. Big 12 predictions for football and the preseason strategy the Chiefs have employed so far this preseason. And what will they do coming up this Friday in their final preseason game before the start of the season, which the beginning of the season will be September 12th against the Browns at Arrowhead. But first, we turn over Dusty, local sports, as we start getting into fall sports. Really starting to get underway this week, and the next week everything will really be full speed ahead.
Yeah, Thursday is our first actual immediate area competition. The Osborne girls will be at the Trigo Round Robin in Waukee, and then four of our area volleyball teams, Beloit, St. John's, Tipton, Osborne, and Thunder Ridge, will all be starting on Friday. But as Wade said, most of the activity and seasons will start next week for a lot of volleyball teams, cross country then next Thursday, football next Friday, September 3rd. So that's kind of the way it'll play out. And we'll be talking with coaches coming up tomorrow on the Sports Ticket. We hope to have our first coach interview and we'll have a few of them Wednesday. We'll talk to coaches Wednesday, Thursday, Friday is our plan right now, and once we have that all set, we'll kind of preview that and tell you who's going to be on, and then next week we'll be chatting with some coaches as well. Locker room chats will start next week on Wednesday and Thursday with our high school football coaches as well. So, yeah, getting right into it and getting this fall sports season started. I know that coaches are excited to have practices going, and we're probably hitting that part of practice time where everybody's really looking forward to getting competition out there and going. We will have a lot of area football teams as well taking part in jamborees coming up on Friday night. I'm going to try to get the schedules out and see where everybody's at for those jamborees as well and pass that along with high school football coming up on this Friday night, August 27th. A little bit of a scrimmage time to get their teams ready for the season opener coming up then the next Friday again on September 3rd. All the latest in local sports can be found at ncksports.com. We have all the schedules posted for the area league schools and also our high school football broadcast schedule there posted at ncksports.com. So, yeah, looking forward to getting the fall sports season started this week and next.
Yeah, we were talking about Royals and Whit Merrifield and Tex saying that Whit said on sports station in Kansas City that he would prefer to stay at second, which obviously that's not a surprise.
Yeah.
And I did read the other day that, you know, Whit said this, it was a few weeks ago, he said he's just now getting back into playing second base every day, even though he has for quite some time, because his whole conditioning program and throwing program in the offseason was he was going to play outfield. Mm-hmm. So he was working on the longer throws. I mean, believe it or not, people, you train for the position you play.
Yeah.
And so, obviously, second base is a different throw than playing center field or right field. Every position's different. There are a lot of times people think that left, right field are the same. They're not. Left field is completely different than right field.
Yeah.
Second base is completely different, shortstop, especially at the big league level. And you can sit here, Mickey Lopez made it look easy going from second to short. And he can play either position. And I totally agree. I would like Whit to stay at second, personally. I really would. The problem is Whit's too multidimensional, and that's why it's going to actually hurt Whit. If Whit's to stay at second, where do you put Lopez? Because Lopez deserves to be an everyday player right now. Lopez, what do you do next year with Lopez? If Whit Jr. or Mondes is your shortstop, are you going to have Lopez come off the bench? That seems – or are you going to trade him? And then Lopez is younger than Whit.
Yeah.
So as much as I agree with Whit, that, and if I were Whit, I wouldn't want to play outfield. I'd want to stay at second and stay there for a long time because Whit's done a really good job defensively there too. Totally get it. The problem is you got to look at your team and your personnel, and it's really no different. Well, it is different, but it's similar in regards to high school football. You know, one year you've got guys that are offensive linemen. The next year you need a fullback, so he moves a fullback.
Yeah.
Or I know Hoisington's going to move a lineman, I think it is, to running back. And we've got Bullitt's going to move a lineman to fullback. You know why? Because they got plenty of linemen, and so they got a guy that they think can play fullback. I don't know if Braden Burks would rather play fullback or offensive line, but in some cases you've got to play whatever is the spot you got to play that's best for the team. You might be a really good quarterback, but if there's a guy that's a better quarterback than you that helps the team, you might have to be wide receiver, even though you could start for everybody else in the league at quarterback and then have to wait your time to be the next quarterback. It's not ideal. It's not the position you want to play, but you're still playing every day. You're starting, and you're making a big contribution to the team. And it does take selfless players to do that. And if you're all about your ego and you're all about, well, I'm a quarterback, I've always been a quarterback, and that's the only position I'm playing, you're either going to be probably sitting on the bench as a backup not playing, or you could decide, I'm going to play another position and play all the time, or you can just not play or quit or be a malcontent.
Yeah.
And most kids, even at the high school level, get the fact that, hey, I'd rather play than be second or third on the depth chart at quarterback or running back when I could be the starting tight end. Or instead of, you know, I like to play linebacker, but they're going to put me at safety. Or I'd be a backup linebacker, I prefer that, but I'm at safety. Or I really would love to be DN to rush the quarterback, but they say that we already got two good DNs, so I'm going to play middle backer. Or our new coach comes into the system and comes up with a whole different defensive system. It could be a 3-3, a 4-2-5, or whatever it might be, and it changes what you're going to do from one year to the next year. And, you know, we've seen this with Hoisington the last few years, different kids playing different spots from year to year based on who is coming back. And you see that all the time. You know, Phillipsburg's going to move a kid, it looks like. It was a running back last year. He's going to have to be the quarterback because their quarterback graduated.
Mm-hmm.
So it is interesting how in high school sports you got to move things around. I'm sure it happens in volleyball. I know it happens in baseball and basketball. You know, here's something. If you got, you know, two really good centers, if you can somehow get the one guy, if he's a little bit more agile and he can guard on the perimeter, maybe he can be your – power forward, even though he's played center, didn't he have extra height on the team? Or you've got two really good point guards, but it's like, dude, they can't. One's got to be my main point guard, while the other hopefully can move over and play the two guard. And then when you need the other one to get a breather, he can slide in. And it's always good to have two guys capable of playing point guard. So with Whit Merrifield, going back to the Royal situation, it's that I totally get where Whit would prefer to play. I would like for him to stay at second as well. I don't like having to jerk him around, play outfield, then infield, and then go back to outfield, and then back to infield. But the problem is Mondesi and Lopez have no experience playing outfield, so they're not candidates to go to the outfield. Hunter Dozier is not a good outfielder. He's better at third or first. And Bobby Witt Jr. doesn't play outfield, and you're not going to put Bobby Witt Jr., who's so good at short. You're going to have him either third or short with that arm. You're not going to put him in the outfield at this point. Mm-hmm. So, honestly, Witt's the odd man out of the infield. Maybe despite anything that Mondesi does. Like you talked about, well, we're assuming that Mondesi's healthy in one scenario. In either scenario, whether Mondesi's healthy or not, if Witt Jr.'s ready opening day next year, he's either your shortstop or third baseman. Mm-hmm. Odds are he's your shortstop. And your third baseman's Dozier. And Lopez doesn't play third, okay? And Witt doesn't play third. But Lopez doesn't play outfield. So would you suddenly try to turn Lopez into an outfielder or Mondesi into an outfielder or instead of Witt because Witt wants to play second? Or would you go, well, Witt's got the experience. He can play outfield. He can play left, right, or center. He's even played first base before. I mean, Witt can play a lot of different positions. He is a utility guy. Some teams look at him like, dude, that's a guy who can play 5-6 different positions. And that's awesome. And you want to be multi-versatile, multi-dimensional. We always say in life, you're a lot more attractive as a candidate to get a job if you can do more than just one thing. I can tell you one thing. If we hire people at the radio station, you can't just do sports. Yeah. It ain't going to work in a small market station. In most radio stations, you can't just do one thing. You got to be able to sell. You got to be able to either do production. You got to be able to host a show. You got to be able to do this. And maybe you do sports or you do sports, but all the other stuff. Or you got to do some news, cover some meetings. And this is no different because Whit, in a way, his talent is going to hurt him. And that seems really crazy to say. But if Witt prefers to play second, and if I were him, I would too. And I think for the longevity of his career, it'd be better for him to play second than the outfield as well. The problem is, and Witt's not stupid, if he looks around and sees the team around him, Witt's a team player, he'll go back to the outfield. I mean, he's not going to be a malcontent, be mad because he's going back to the outfield. He wants to win, and he said this before. You know, if I got to play outfield, and that's what we got to do to win, and that's what he accepted going into the season. The problem, and that's what happened when Nicky Lopez came up, remember? Mm-hmm. It's okay, I got to move the outfield if this makes us better. Lopez doesn't know how to play outfield. Mondesi doesn't play outfield. Maybe they could eventually get Mondesi to be a project and go in the outfield. But that really doesn't open up anything for Witt when you do that, because then Witt's going to be your shortstop and Lopez is second. Because if Mondesi isn't ready to go at short, I don't think they're going to put Witt Jr. at third and Lopez at short. I just don't see that happening. Yeah. I don't think they think the Lopez is their shortstop of the future. See, maybe your second baseman of the future. So I totally get where Witt's coming from, and I even said it earlier, I wouldn't want to be jerked around outfield, infield, outfield, infield, but when you're the one guy on this team that's capable of doing it, odds are you're going to be asked to do it.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, as a fan and a pro and a team, right, you want to put the guys out there that are the best for the spots that you can average out everything and put field the best nine guys at whatever position they're at. But as Whit Merrifield, it's like, okay, I'm in my sixth year with you guys. I've been doing everything you ask me to do.
Right.
When's it my turn to do what I want to do?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the mentality that somebody like that's going to have, right? I mean, I've done this for you for years, and now I'm finally kind of in the groove here. This is my spot. But then he knows, I mean, he's not going to put up a big stink about it, but he's just going to say, hey, I've been doing a lot for you over the last 6 years. This is my sixth year with the big league club.
Right.
Playing every day if I can.
Right.
But again, it's like, okay, I guess I'll move. I need to move.
I don't, as long as Bobby Witt Jr. is ready to go opening day next year, I don't think Witt starts in the infield.
No.
I just don't see the scenario. The only scenario is if Lopez is hurt. you know, there's enough injuries where he starts at second, but eventually go back to the outfield. And then, of course, the next step would be, as you just said, if you talk to the team, say, I've done all this, and you put your needs ahead of the team's needs, and you say, well, okay, I'm not happy here, I want traded.
Yeah.
And how many times has he been, people have talked about him being traded, and it sounds like Witt's been very adamant that he didn't want to really, he wants to stay in KC.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden he's going to just do a 180 and say, I want out of KC, because it's one thing to want out when you don't get to play as much as you want, or there's a guy that's blocking you. Witt's going to play every day. I mean, there's a place for him because he is so versatile. So that will be something to watch next year for the Royals. The other thing, too, about Witt is, and this is why some people have said this, and I, you know, I love Whit Merrifield. I love his story. I love the fact he's a late bloomer. We said when Mondesi was making the team at a young age instead of Witt, we thought it was a bunch of, you know what? But, you know, the high talent prospect was Adalberto Mondesi. And Witt got left behind, coming out of spring training. The next thing, there's an injury, and then he's had the opportunity. And, of course, he's made the most of it. But, you know, Witt is going to be 33 in January.
Yeah.
And so that's why when people got all riled up, people that love Witt, and I get it, well, we love Witt. Okay, true, you love Witt. Whit Merrifield, not Bobby Witt Jr., we love both. But Whit Merrifield we love. You can't trade him. I've even had a couple of Royals fans that told me that. Oh, I love Whit Merrifield. You can't trade him. I'm like, well, are you okay with winning 60 to 70 games every year? You know, Jared Allen was great for the Chiefs. He got lots of sacks. They were 2-14. What good to do you? Like, as a Royals fan, do you care more about Whit Merrifield or the team winning? For me, I care more about the team winning because that's my team. Players come and go. It sounds harsh, but it's true. And listen, if Whit Merrifield is part of the team, that's great. But if you're really looking down the line, if you're sitting here going, okay, Witt Jr. is going to be ready opening day. And the Royals should have maybe thought about, and well, they probably did. Maybe they just didn't get a good enough offer for Whit Merrifield. But you may look back next year after this thing's put together, and you may look back and go, why didn't the Royals move Whit Merrifield at the trade deadline? The Royals were out of the playoff race, basically, unless they go super hot here the rest of the way. So why did you keep Whit Merrifield? Because if Whit Jr. is ready to go opening day, he's going to play shorter third. We've gone through this. And even if Mondesi doesn't play, you got Lopez at second, Dozier at third, and Witt Jr. at short. And, yeah, you got to find an outfielder. But if Witt isn't a guy that wants to play the outfield, then that's not an option for you anyway. And so you trade a 32-year-old player who's still in his prime, having a pretty solid year, not quite as good as he's had the last couple of years, but still pretty solid. You would have got something for him. And that was the argument about trading Whit Merrifield. And that's projecting and looking down in the future. And who knows, maybe Mondesi not being healthy prevented the Royals from trading with Merrifield. If Mondesi was perfectly healthy and was having a really good year, and Lopez was doing what he's doing at the plate while he's playing second, and Witt was playing outfield, well, one, maybe Witt would be cool with it because he's like, dude, I know I ain't going to play infield anymore. I'm an outfielder. No big deal. Or maybe the Royals would have moved him in that situation. I don't know. But I do know that the older he gets, the less valuable he becomes. And he's 32. And, yes, he does have 10 years of Major League Baseball experience, maybe not as much wear and tear. And I love Whit Merrifield. I also love Zach Greinke pitching for the Royals and winning the Cy Young. That didn't translate into wins.
No.
I mean, he had the lowest win total of any Cy Young Award pitcher at the time. So I'm – and what happened when the Royals traded Zach Greinke?
They got a bunch of prospects, and then it led to a lot of winning in a championship.
Yes, it did. They got their center fielder and shortstop on championship clubs. And they also turned into ALCS MVPs, by the way. That started everything for the Royals to turn the corner. They got actually made a trade where they got really solid prospects at key positions, shortstop and center field. Now, the thing about Greinke back then was he didn't want to come back to the Royals. He made it clear that he didn't really want to be a part of a losing team. And so he was a key to trading him to get the pieces the Royals need to build a championship contender. Whit Merrifield hasn't said anything about wanting out. And I don't think he really will. But let's say he does. Well, then you got to move him.
Yeah.
You do got to move him. And honestly, at the age of 30, well, next spring training or next season, he'll be 33. If you don't trade Whit next year, when are you going to trade him? And I'm not saying you should have to, but people get in love with players. Well, we can't trade this guy. I love him. Do you want to win, or do you just want to go ahead and see Whit steal 40 bases and go, yay, we led the league in stolen bases? Because I love Whit. I love his story. He's kind of been an underdog his whole career, and I would love him see him play his whole career as a Royal, no question about it. But if that if that means we're just going to keep winning 60 to 75 games every year and not really be a contender. I know Witt wants to be a contender. You could actually do everybody a favor, trade Witt to a contender next year, and you've got guys ready to take these positions where you don't have to have Witt, and you get something back for him. Mm-hmm. And it'd be a win-win for everybody. And if you really care about Witt as a Royals fan, if you truly, truly, really care about Witt personally, you should want him to be a part of a winning team, because he's not been a part of a winning team. Okay, he came up after the Royals won the World Series in 15. He wasn't on the team in 14 or 15. So if you truly, truly, when you sit here and say, I love Witt and I really love Witt, but then you don't want him to go anywhere else, well, you're being selfish. You want to be a Royal because he's your favorite player. But if you really, really cared about Witt as a person, you would say, hey, man, we're not going to be ready to contend for a few years. Witt's going to be 33. Let's give him a chance. Let's get something for him. That's a win for us. He goes to a team, contends, makes the playoffs, and we can cheer him on in the playoffs. I know that's not ideal. I know the, you know, get your cake and have your icing on top of it and everything comes with it. Of course, we're all greedy. The perfect scenario is Witt sticks around, the Royals get good, and Witt's playing in the World Series as a Royal. I get that. But do we really think, and we talked about this, when do we think the Royals are going to be a championship contender again? When do we think the Royals are going to be a bona fide playoff team that can win their division? When do we think the Royals are going to do that? Well, we don't think it's next year. So that's 2022. We've talked recently about 2024. Some people have said 2025. Okay, so let's just go with 2024. 2024, Witt will be 35 years old. Will Witt be a part of this team? Whether he breaks down, whether he's not any good anymore and declines, or whether he's traded, will he even be a part of this team 3 years from now? I have my doubts. He might be an older utility guy that doesn't play every day. Maybe that's how he'll be on this team. I don't see Whit Merrifield at the age of 35 being an everyday player on a championship team in Kansas City.
No.
And maybe I'm just being too negative, but I just got to be realistic. You can be optimistic all you want. I'm just being realistic. And that's the thing we asked about not too long ago. How many of the guys on the Royals team right now are pieces of the puzzle to win a World Series title? We said that. We've talked about that. Is Salvi still going to be around? Is he going to be healthy enough? Will he break down? You know, at 34 years of age, when Salvi's 34, 35, are the Royals going to be any good? I mean, not just Witt, yeah. And Salvi too, because he's got wear and tear. He's been in the league for a decade, which is hard to believe. You know, what guys are part of this? Hunter Dozier just turned 30. He's no spring chicken. Is Hunter Dozier going to be a key piece of this team in 3 years? If you believe 2024 is the year the Royals are going to finally get it figured out, if that's the target date, 3 years from now, that means Dozier's 33, Witt's 35, and Salvi, how old's Salvi?
Oh, gotta be 30-something. The other day, I thought he was...
Salvi would be 34.
Yeah.
So 3 years from now, Salvi's 34, Witt's 35, and Dozier's 33. Usually championship teams don't have that much age at three key positions. Mm-hmm. They rarely do. So I think odds are, 3 years from now, I don't think Dozier is a big piece of this team. 3 years from now, I think Salvi could be, but I think maybe in a DH role. And 3 years from now, I don't think Witt's an everyday player on this team on a championship club. If you want to look at the pieces the Royals have in place to be a championship team in 3 years from now, if that's the target date that people agree on, let's just say we do agree on it, 2024. Witt Jr. is one of those pieces. Nick Prado is one of those pieces. MJ Melendez, hopefully, is one of those pieces. Mm-hmm. Nicky Lopez could be one of those pieces. Okay, there's four. Let's say you assume Salvi. There's five. Benintendi, is he part of this? I doubt it.
No.
Taylor isn't, obviously. Who else you got outfield-wise? I can't come up with anybody. Is Lynch? Yeah, you better hope so.
Yeah.
Hernandez? You got to hope so. Singer? You got to hope so. All right. Is Bubich? You hope so. Okay, there's nine. Now we're nine. Is Staumont part of this puzzle 3 years from now? 10. Is there anybody else that's on this team from now that's part of a championship team? Because the reason I'm doing the math here is there's 25-man roster, sometimes 26, whatever. If you got 10 guys on this team that are going to be a part of the team 3 years from now, that means you have 40% of your championship team put together. You have 60% to put together between now and 2024, which really sounds daunting. It's actually... If you got 40% in place now, you're actually in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
To be quite honest with you. Now, the bonus would be Witt plays great and he's 35 and he's playing at the top of his game and he's an all-star. Well, now you got 11. And Dozier refines his stroke, and he's mashing the next 3 years. Okay, now we're at 12. Now we're getting super optimistic. Mm-hmm. You know, we're getting super optimistic. Brad Keller is going to be great again. He's going to be awesome and refined it. All right, ooh, we're at 13, you know? Okay, that's good if that happens, but it's very doubtful all that's going to fall in the perfect place. So more than likely the Royals have 5 instead of 10 3 years from now, because guys could get injured, throw out their arm, you know, struggle all of a sudden, like Soler and Dozier out of the blue just struggled like they did this year. And then you traded Soler, didn't you? A couple years ago, he's hitting 48 homers, and I would have told you 2024 Soler on this team, you probably would have said, yeah, we find a way to have him.
Yeah.
And you know, he's gone. That's how quickly things can change. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next year with the Royals. I know it's a long way off. It's kind of fun to talk about, though, because there is optimism. Mm-hmm. There is some, like, hey, man, we got some talent, and we could be a lot better. And maybe next year will be the Royals 2013. You remember 2013 where the Royals got better and were 10 games over 500? That set the tone. And the next year they surprised everybody, got hot after the All-Star break and made it to the Game 7 of the World Series at home against the Giants and got in as a wild card. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe next year is the Royals 2013 and 2023 is the target date. Now, if 2023 is the year that the Royals can win the division and go to the World Series, Witt and Salvi and Dozier are more likely to be a part of this.
Yeah.
Obviously. Is there anybody I'm leaving out that you think could be a key part of this team in the future that's close right now or
not
on the Major League roster?
For sure. You know, like Coar or guys like that,
right,
that you hope could be, but you're just not sure yet, right?
Yeah. And there's no guarantee Prado or Melendez will pan out. Well, there's no guarantee Bobby Witt Jr. will either. I mean, there is no guarantee. No. He seems like a surefire.
Until you see it, there's no guarantee. Yeah.
He could come up and struggle, too much hype, too much pressure. He'd come up and get hurt, like Mondesi. I mean, Mondesi looked like a can't-miss guy, and now he can't even play. All right, the latest news from Pac-12 on expansion is that it doesn't sound like they want to. Dusty was all over this from the very first day we talked about this, and I don't know why other people haven't really caught on. Some people are starting to catch on. I guess they wanted to wait till they heard it from the horse's mouth. But there are insiders with the Pac-12 saying that they don't really feel like anybody from the Big 12 adds value to their league. Huh. This guy named Dusty Dinah said that way back. You take Oklahoma, Texas away the Big 12, you don't have a lot of value. Now, right away, K-State and KU fans get all riled up when you say that. Just presenting facts because you do provide value. I know there's value. I have great people I know at KU and K-State. There is value. You can get great education at both schools. They both have good athletic programs. Football's, I still think, is solid at K-State. KU basketball, of course, is fantastic. We know that. And each have their struggles. You know, K-State men's basketball struggles, KU football struggles. We get all that. But they're both good, solid universities. There's nothing wrong with the universities. But from a standpoint of making money and bringing people to watch, there's, from a football standpoint, you're not going to draw in tons of people across the country to watch K-State or KU play football, or Iowa State, or TCU, or Texas Tech, or Baylor, or any of these teams that are remaining, West Virginia, Oklahoma State. So there is not a lot of value. If you bring in somebody, you better have a lot of value because you're going to divvy up the TV money to another mouth to feed. If you add, let's say they add Texas Tech and TCU. Let's say the Pac-12 says, we'll take the Texas schools. Okay, there's 6 schools now. I got to figure out what the heck they're going to do, including KU, K-State. They're going to scramble. But Texas Tech and TCU, let's just say that the Pac-12 goes, we'll take that Texas footprint. They go to 14 schools. Well, now the TV money's got to be divided by 14 instead of 12. So if they got to divvy it up, and let's say it goes, the payout, I'm just making up numbers here. I have no idea. I don't have it in front of me. I think the Pac-12 was, how much were they making per year per school on their TV deal? I don't know what the total amount was, but see if you can figure that out real quick, because we'll pull a calculator and do some quick math the best that we can. I know the Big 12 is around $38 million. The Big 10 was 50, and the SEC was 44. The Pac-12 was, I think, below the Big 12, actually, in average money.
Roughly $32.2 million per school.
Okay, so 32.2 times 12 schools is $386 million. Okay, so $386 million divided by 12 is $32 million a year. Were you with me?
Yeah.
Okay. So now you divide that by 14. You add 2 mouths to feed, assuming the TV deal stays the same, which it probably won't. And now every school makes $5 million less because you have 2 more mouths to feed.
Mm.
So that means that $5 million less times 12, so that's $60 million taken away from current schools. You with me?
Yes.
$5 million less times 12 schools is 60. That's my Trigo education kicking in. So $60 million less to all the schools means that that means that Texas Tech and TCU, in the scenario I presented, needs to bring in probably well over $60 million to make this really work. Because these schools don't want to just keep making what they're making. They're going to want to make, instead of 32, they're going to want to, like, if you come in, if we add Texas Tech and TCU, there's got to be value. So if we assume there's value there and the Texas footprint from that standpoint, and yes, we don't have the University of Texas, we don't have A&M, but we got the next best thing. We got Tech and TCU. If they believe that, then let's say you're going to want this Pac-12 deal, the TV deal. If you add Texas, one of the biggest states in our country, you're just going to sit here and say, okay, we should probably at least get bumped up to 35, 36, 37, 38 million per year, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so now from 27 million that you would be cut down to with the current TV deal if you added two mouths to feed in TCU and Texas Tech, you go to 27, but you got to get it probably to 35, I'd say 40, honestly. So let's just split the difference, 37. You want to make five more million. Like, if we add TCU and Texas Tech, they're going to add 5 million to every single school's bank account. Yeah. Okay? That's what we're talking about. If we add you, we shouldn't just be making the same amount of money. We got to be making more money per year with our TV deal. That's where we have interest in you. So that would mean that if you want to go from 32 million, which is currently, and you want to go to, I would argue, 40 million. Mm-hmm. That's a nice round number. 40 million times 14 schools, all right, if you had two mouths to feed, is $560 million. Which means that when you add schools to your conference, you're not looking to make the same amount of money on your TV deal. You're wanting to increase the money for each school. That's where the value comes in. So if Texas Tech, TCU, or if you just want to go KU, K-State, let's just shift to KU, K-State, right? KU and K-State would need to bring $90 million per school in added value to make it attractive for the Pac-12 to add KU and K-State. Do you think KU and K-State brings an extra $90 million to the table in value?
No.
And that's why Pac-12 isn't...
Together, they might bring a third of that.
Exactly.
Like, we're not talking separate.
No. So we go back to the, you know, people that don't fully get the whole big picture, because it is about money. And, you know, radio guy that I know down south doesn't understand that. KU and K-State, this is a business. So if KU and K-State can't bring an extra $90 million in value to the table, then why should the Pac-12 add KU and K-State? And let me go over the numbers again. The Pac-12 right now, each school, which there's 12, gets $32 million a year. If you simply add KU and K-State and have the same TV deal, it goes down to $27 million a year. Well, nobody in their right mind is going to bring on schools and take less money. That's never going to happen. So $32 million, you're going to want to bump it up. And so we just went with around number 40. Maybe it's 37. I don't know. Could be a little less. The bottom line is you're going to want to have more. So let's say you go 32, and let's go low end, and $35 million. Okay, that means KU and K-State both have to bring $50 million in value, added value, to a TV deal. Do you think KU or K-State, West Virginia, Iowa State, Oklahoma State, Baylor, Texas Tech, or TCU, do you think any of those eight institutions automatically bring you $50 million minimum? Now, I'm talking probably closer to 100. $50 to $100 million in added value. Do you think any of the universities by themselves bring you $50 to $100 million in extra added value?
No.
I don't either. And that's why I don't think the Pac-12 is going to expand, and they'd probably be dumb to expand. And you may say, well, the Pac-12 needs to expand so they can compete with the SEC and the Big Ten. Well, I agree with you. I agree with you. And here's what people are kind of missing in this whole thing. The Pac-12 probably wants to expand, but they ain't looking at the Big Eight. I say Big Eight. There's only eight left, technically. Or the Big 12, I should say. The current Big 12 without Texas, Oklahoma. The Pac-12, when they say we're not interested in adding, they might be just saying that, saying we're not interested in expansion. Listen very carefully to what they say. Are they talking about adding just to add, or are they talking about expansion? There's a little bit of a difference. And when you're talking expansion, you're talking about you want to make more money. When you say add, I think you're just adding to add. And these conferences aren't going to add to add. Why do you think SEC took Oklahoma and Texas and nobody else from the Big 12? They didn't go after KU basketball. They didn't go after K-State football. I mean, they went after the two big kahunas, or they contacted the SEC about, and then it was a mutual thing. It was a no-brainer. You know, you get the two prettiest girls at the ball, man. If you can, that's great. You get the two handsome guys at the reunion, all right, if you're a single lady. Whatever, you got your pick. You're not going to – I mean, if you're left with the eight, no offense, they're nice people and all, but what added value do they have, you know? There's nothing of these eight remaining schools that is going to bring that much value to any conference, in my opinion, and you agree with me.
Yeah.
And so thus, why would the Pac-12 expand and add schools from the Big 12 unless they think we could have this super merger and we could have a 20-team conference? But you have a 20-team conference, but you're not adding any marquee value with the eight. You're adding average situation, basically. Mm-hmm. So now if you added the Big 12 and Texas and Oklahoma as a part of it, now you've got a 24 or a 22-team conference, or you say we don't want a couple from the Big 12 and have an even 20. The Pac-12, they're going to expand. They're going to go grab somebody somewhere else. I mean, honestly, BYU would probably be a better pickup for the Pac-12 than anybody in the Big 12 remaining.
Yeah.
To be quite honest with you. And if I'm the Pac-12, you know, I don't know who is out there to go get. If you're the Big Ten, you're making $50 million. You ain't taking somebody that's going to bring your amount down. So I don't think KU basketball brings you $100 million in added value. But if it does, then they should consider adding KU, if that's the case.
Well,
I'm not privy to all those numbers. But the Big Ten ain't going to rush into anything. And the Big Ten's going to go after Notre Dame, if they're smart. Big Ten's going to go after USC or UCLA and try to get L.A. market. They're going to get something that's going to add to their TV deal so that every school in the Big Ten makes more than $50 million a year.
They're at 55.6 right now.
That was 50 recently,
yeah.
So there's different numbers there.
I mean,
they're
going to
have a new TV deal.
They're going to
have a new TV deal. It's going to go about, it might be just as high as the SEC.
Yeah.
So if you're Nebraska, you start getting together and you vote on who, like Nebraska is part of the Big Ten. That's just in. So when you vote, When the Big Ten members vote on, and they vote on expansion, the Big 12 voted to not add anybody a couple years ago, even though 17 institutions had a full PowerPoint presentation, and the Big 12 said, we're good with our 10. Because why did they choose to do that, Dusty?
Because they're not getting anything extra out of it.
The 17 candidates that applied were not good enough to add enough to the conference. So the Big 12 turned down expansion because they didn't think that there was enough added to this conference. I still think they should have added Louisville. I think Louisville could have added more than anybody of the other 17. Whatever, they didn't, so be it. So 17 schools were out there, and they didn't take a single one. Now the Big 12 has 8 schools, and people that are all Big 12 proponents saying that the Big 12's got to find somewhere, and KU and K-State fans are all about, well, we're a great university, and yes, you are, but we've got a good football team, we got a good basketball program. Well, surely one of the big conferences will take us in because we add value or whatever else. You have to ask yourself, why didn't you add teams a few years ago while your members, KU and K-State, voted on this? Why did KU and K-State and the Big 12 vote down? And I don't know exactly the vote. Maybe KU and K-State voted for it. I don't know. In regards to adding teams a few years back when 17 applied. The reason is there was no value that was really, it wasn't going to, if we have more mouths to feed, you don't bring in more than what we're going to lose. We need to, we don't want to stay status quo. We don't want to keep making the same amount of money. If we're going to bring somebody in to our family, you've got to have a job, all right? You're going to help support this family. We're just not going to give you a whole bunch of dessert and feed you these 5-course meals. We will if you work really hard and make a lot of money for the Gershner or Dinas family. Now we'll add in a couple adopted kids. You betcha. You can add something to this family. You're not just going to say, you're not Freddie Freeloader. We're not going to let you be Freddie Freeloader. So you got to bring value to the table, all right? Not everything is free. Well, in this case, you've got to bring more than what they're currently making. And you got to bring more just from the very simple standpoint that if you're added to a conference of 12 and it goes to 14, you divvy the pie 2 more ways, which means the other 12 got a pay cut. Who likes pay cuts? Raise your hands out there, everybody listening. The answer is none of us like pay cuts. So you got to think of it from a financial standpoint. And I know people go, well, it takes the fun out of college sports. I'm sorry, that's the reality of what we have. It's called a business.
That didn't just happen yesterday.
No, it's been a long time. That's why Nebraska left, for crying out loud. So when you get to a vote, and let's say KU is up for a vote, right? The Big Ten says, listen, KU is interested. Are we interested in taking them? And you have a vote, whether it's an informal or formal vote. The Big Ten institutions get together, all right? Then there's how many of them right now? 14?
14. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
It's confusing. Big Ten has 14. So the Big Ten has 14 institutions. One of those is Nebraska. Do you think Nebraska is going to vote for KU to be added or K-State to their conference if they're going to get less money?
No.
Of course not. Well, but we would be able to drive, and it'd be a closer, it'd be great for the fans, and it'd be a closer drive. Which, you know what? I'm with you. I would vote for it as a fan. But if I was a leader at Nebraska, I would say, okay, yeah, it'd be great. I'd love for us to go play K-State in Manhattan and them to come up here. Love to run down the Lawrence and play KU. That'd be great. That'd be fun. It, basketball, football, whatever. That'd be awesome. We're cool with that. That's fantastic. Yeah, but in order to do that, you're going to have to take $5 million less per year. Yeah, I'm going to pass. It's not that important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thinking that goes behind this stuff, folks. It is called the bottom line. The bottom line. Nobody that's getting $50, $55 million a year or $32 million, whatever the number is in whatever conference. Do you think the SEC would have added Texas, Oklahoma if they would still only get $44 million per year? No.
No.
The reason they had Texas, Oklahoma, even if they don't like them, the reason they add Texas, Oklahoma is because they see that every school is going to make $16 to $20 million more per year, so we can make it work and add them to have 16. Why does Texas and Oklahoma choose to leave the Big 12? Well, come on, man. They're breaking up the Big 12. What are they thinking? We need them. Well, if you had a chance to make, instead of $37 million a year for your college, you could make 60. Would you at K-State and KU go to the SEC? Would you do the same thing Oklahoma, Texas did? Hell yeah, you would. You'd get an extra $23 million a year. Of course you would. Don't sit here and cast stones at things that you would do yourself. And that's why I find it so interesting that people got their colored lenses on so tightly that they have headaches. Their glasses are on so tight with purple or crimson and blue, they don't understand the beast, man. You don't understand the animal. And you can hate the animal all you want. You can hate the beast that is college athletics, and you can hate the money aspect. That's fine and dandy, all right? That's fine and dandy, all right? I can hate people that don't use their blinkers when they drive. I still got to deal with it. And that's what you got to do as a college sports fan. You either got to deal with it and adjust to the times, or you need to quit supporting college athletics and just quit doing it. That's your choice. Mm-hmm. Texas, Oklahoma had a choice to go to the SEC and make more money. And they're going to make a lot more of it. They made the decision any other institution in America would have made. Every other school in America would have made that choice. I can't think of one that wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
I can think about it. You go from $37 an hour and somebody offers you $60 an hour, odds are you're probably going to take it. You're going to find a way, right?
Yeah.
So those are the dynamics you're dealing with conference realignment. So when the Pac-12 sits here and says, well, you know, we're going to decide in a couple weeks we're going to expand or add. Listen, to me, it has nothing to do with the Big 12. If they're going to expand or add, it's going to be trying to poach somebody from somewhere else or find an independent like a Notre Dame or BYU. It is not going to be, oh, yeah, we're going to go grab TCU and Baylor. I just don't see that happening. Unless the numbers somehow bear it out, the Oklahoma State, you know, wow, we can bring something from the state of Oklahoma because Oklahoma's going that way. Oklahoma, the other part of Oklahoma can go to the west. Oklahoma State might be attractive. The other thing that people argue about, well, K-State's better than Vanderbilt. So, Vanderbilt's already in. First one's in, win. If you think
Nashville's a highly bigger market than Manhattan.
Nashville's a bigger market. Now, it could be down the line. You could see that. You could see the Pac-12, the SEC, the Big Ten. You could see them get rid of some weak sisters and try to get an upgrade. And if you kick Rutgers to the curb, I'm going to tell you right now, K-State or KU is not an upgrade. And you can say, what do you mean? Rutgers sucks at everything. Once again, it ain't about that. It's about the TV sets. It's the market. And I'm sorry, Rutgers market is a bigger – that's why they're part of the conference now. It's a TV market, and it's a lot bigger than what KU and K-State have or can offer, unfortunately. It's just the facts of the game. You can hate on the facts. You can hate on the messenger all you want. but those are the facts. And so while I love to see KUNK State go to the Pac-12, the Big Ten, the ACC, I really hope they go to a Power Five conference. I really do. I just think the odds are completely against both our universities in the state and everybody remaining in the Big 12. I just don't see a scenario where the Big Ten, the Pac-12, or the ACC is going to add anybody. People are like, well, they'll take on all eight schools. Nobody's taking on all eight schools. So let's just stop with that. And that's why every single university president and AD right now has got to be knocking on the door, like they should have been doing for months, saying, can we come in? Because you don't have much. If the Pac-12 is not an option, and by the way, it leads to our next story, the Big Ten, ACC, and Pac-12 are expected to formally announce their long-awaited alliance this afternoon. That doesn't help the Big 12.
Well, as you're talking about all this and this move right here,
to me, it tells you the Big 12
renders conference expansion for those three conferences moot. It doesn't matter anymore.
Right. They don't need
it. That's why they're doing it.
Because there's nobody out there of added value, and they know they can't sway Notre Dame to change what they're doing, and that's about the only big player that's out there.
Yeah. And Notre Dame's getting $15 million a year from NBC just for home games.
Yes.
That's
yes.
not their whole deal.
And they got a sweet deal in the ACC
yeah,
with others.
Yeah, and so. Exactly. And I mean, when that comes out yesterday, well, it's been they've been talking about it, but when it comes out and it'll probably be made official today, that just proved what I was talking about earlier, right?
That
no, these conferences need to know that whoever they're bringing in is going to add value. And expansion doesn't add value for those three conferences, but an alignment with the other two conferences, if you're the Big Ten or
brings more value.
Whoever, that's where they get their value from. That's where they've figured out, hey, Oklahoma and Texas are going to the SEC. They're probably two of the only players that we would even want mm-hmm. from any of the other conferences in the country right now. I mean, the SEC is not going to give anybody up. Nobody wants it. We don't want anybody else from the Big 12. And so what do? How do we increase our revenue? Oh, hey, let's all get together and make more money.
Yeah.
You don't have to join our conference. It's not what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're not going to create this big old super conference, but we're going to make sure that we're playing each other and make a deal with the TV networks that they like that we can expand upon and make our money that way. It's
right.
Not everything has to be driven by expansion. It's driven by however you can make the money.
Right. Well, talks between the Big Ten, ACC, and Pac-12 have been described as a non-aggression pact against the SEC.
Yeah.
After the Big 12 was destabilized following the losses of Texas, Oklahoma, the power grab tipped the scales towards the SEC and future college athletic dealings. And there's no question about it. They got some of the biggest brand names, Oklahoma, Texas, Alabama, LSU. You know, Georgia's not bad either. They got some big-time, obviously, universities. And we'll see how this affects, you know, football, playoff expansion, and so forth and so on. It's not that they're all merging together. It's an alliance. And you said it very, very well, but I'll repeat it in case people missed it. The Big Ten and the ACC and the Pac-12 have come to the conclusion they probably looked at the landscape when Texas Oklahoma left or announced they were leaving. The Big Ten, ACC, Pac-12, the Big 12, everybody looked at the landscape, and the Big 12 probably started to freak out. And the Big Ten, ACC, and Pac-12 was hearing all the noise about, okay, we can poach these teams from the Big 12, and these Big 12 teams might be knocking on our door. And I'm sure the Big Ten, ACC, and Pac-12 looked at the resumes. They looked at everything of the eight schools remaining in the Big 12, and they came to the conclusion that we knew right away. There's not enough value that any of these people bring. But what could we do to add to our value as the Big Ten, the ACC, and the Pac-12 to combat what the SEC just did by poaching Oklahoma and Texas? What can we do to create a little bit more value so that we can compete against the big boy SEC? Well, we're not going to poach anybody from anywhere. But we're going to work together to go against the big bad SEC. And there's more value in doing that than adding KU, K-State, Iowa State to our conferences. And honestly, makes total sense.
Absolutely does.
And the Big 12 and people that rail about it are just simply, honestly, people that are so close to their university and they're thinking with their heart and not their head. And I get it. Don't get me wrong. If you're an alum of KU or K-State, you're going to fight to the death for your university. And that's what you should do. As an alum, you should do that. You understand what's so great about your university. There's no question about that. I'm not trying to devalue the universities at all. I'm just saying in the big landscape of college athletics and college sports, and it's really college football, this is a business. And unfortunately, the small, and this is what we're seeing in America. You know, the story the other day was Amazon's going to buy a whole bunch of buildings and have retail stores. Yeah, they're going to go probably buy retail stores of businesses that they put out of business. Mm-hmm. The big businesses take over the small guys. Small guys eventually do what? They either got to merge with a big guy, or they've got to probably phase out or go out of business. That's what we have here. The Big 12 is the Small Businesses of America Conference. And right now, they're trying to hang on. And they can't find a good option to get other small businesses to join them that can form a big enough alliance to kick butt. This is another nail in the coffin for the Big 12, in my opinion. I mean, honestly, it really, the Big 12 is still going to continue because there's nowhere to go. So maybe the Big 12 will continue, but it's not going to be a Power 5 conference anymore. No. It's going to be like the Mountain West or AAC, which might still be a decent, solid conference. But you're becoming basically the small market, small business conference of America with all this happening.
Yeah. You want to, as a K-State fan, a KU fan, Iowa State, whoever you are in these schools in the Big 12, it's like you love your school so much and you want this to happen so bad that you actually start believing it can't happen.
Yes.
That this is actually, yeah, hey, we're going to go to the Pac-12. KU basketball, we're going to go to the ACC. They want us for basketball. Mm-hmm. Big Ten wants us for basketball.
Right.
You start believing in your mind because you want it so bad. You want success. You want your team to have, your school, whoever it is, to have these opportunities that you start believing what you're actually putting in your mind and trying to sell.
You don't think
and
objectively
it's
anymore.
Not going to happen. And I think there are some dreams that you'll put in your mind and you put the work in.
Sure.
They happen. But if you understand the landscape of what's going on here and why these decisions are being made, no K-State fan in their right mind that is logically thinking about this should think that they're going to join any of these other three conferences, because the SEC is pretty well done with what they've got. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that Kansas and Kansas State don't add value.
They don't
like
add
these other schools.
They don't
do.
Add enough value.
The right kind of value. Yeah, right. Yeah. And so, actually, they don't add value. I don't feel like they don't add any value for the teams that are in the Pac-12. No. We just went through it, right?
Yes, we did.
Because they've got to add extra, which is, if you're not adding extra, that's not adding any value.
And the comeback that K&K State fans have been saying here now suddenly is, well, we're better than Oregon State. We're better than Arizona State. That's great and all, but you're not a member.
Their value's already set. They're still there. They didn't go anywhere else.
Now, had you already been there, then Arizona State and Oregon State would be on the outside looking in just like you all.
Absolutely, they would.
You just were hitched to the wrong wagon, unfortunately. Yeah. You know? It sucks for the remaining Big 12 schools. There's no doubt about it. And I know, and that's why people are so mad at Oklahoma and Texas for leaving them in a lurch. But Oklahoma and Texas did what was best for their universities and for their financial pockets. And like I said, anybody else in America would have done the exact same thing. And you can hate on Oklahoma and Texas all you want in regards to this. And I get it. And you can say that destabilized the conference and that put us in this situation. You've known that for decades. You've known that for a couple decades. If you didn't know that back in 2010 when Nebraska and A&M and others left the conference, then you weren't paying attention. And the fact that you think it was going to somehow get better and better and better, we said back then in 2010 and 11 that as soon as this TV deal in 2025 is over, the Big 12 is probably dead anyway. Because we knew it wasn't going to just keep lasting. We knew that Texas was going to want more because they're Texas. It's not something that should be a surprise to a lot of people, and it should not be a surprise to the higher-ups, especially the commissioner of our conference, Butch, who apparently he was, which just blows my mind. Okay, there will be Big 12 football this year, okay?
Yes.
Oklahoma and Texas will be playing, and CBS Sports has all their experts, and I say that loosely, as to the picks and who's going to be winning the Big 12. Who do you think they all picked to win the Big 12?
Probably Oklahoma.
Who do you think they all picked to finish second?
Probably Iowa State.
Who do you think they picked to finish third?
Texas?
Three of them picked Texas, two Oklahoma State, one TCU, and one West Virginia. How many, where do you think the highest vote, how high do you think they had, seven writers for CBSSports.com put their predictions for the Big 12. What's the highest spot K-State was on any of these guys' lists? What do you think? Highest spot.
Say seven.
The highest spot?
Yeah.
One guy's got them at four.
Really?
And three guys got them at five. And two guys got them at seven. One guy's got them at nine.
Really? I figure they usually undervalue K-State. So
K-State is anywhere from 4 to 9, okay? Who do you think they all picked to finish 10th? I say 10th just to be nice to KU fans.
Kansas.
KU's going to finish 10th out of the Big 12. That's pretty good. There's third from last, right? No, there's only 10. So they're last. No surprise there. Texas, three of them said Texas for third, 2 for 4th, 1 for 5th, and one person at Texas finished 7th. So K-State, one guy picked them 4th, 3 guys 5th. Nobody picked them 6th, which is weird. 2 picked them 7th, 1 picked them 9th, just ahead of KU. And KU wins automatically last place with these experts. Yeah. Can't disagree with the KU part.
No.
Can't disagree with the Oklahoma part. Can't really disagree with the Iowa State part. The K-State part, obviously, there's a wide opinion.
Kind of like every year, really.
Like every year at K-State. I am surprised somebody has them at 4.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't put them at 9 myself, but whatever. The Chiefs have made some interesting, well, not interesting moves. Well, they have during the offseason. There's no question about that. Let's hear from Andy Reid. I'll have you go get Marvin real quick, if you don't mind.
I'm going to stay over there because I got an interview.
You got an interview? Okay, so we're going to let Dusty go. But the Chiefs have been one of the teams, not very many teams, that have been playing their starters in preseason. In fact, Patrick Mahomes played 33 snaps in the Chiefs' second preseason game last Friday against the Cardinals. Matthew Stafford for the Rams, Aaron Rodgers for the Packers, they're not even going to play this preseason. The league's arguably best quarterback, Mahomes, is playing a whole first half as he did the other day, for almost the first half, against Arizona. And the offensive line was in there the whole first half against Arizona, which, remember, the offensive line is brand new, so that probably makes some sense for them to work on some communication and continuity. Here's Andy Reid on the strategy of guys that are starters, including Patrick Mahomes, playing a lot of snaps in preseason when other teams are maybe scared to guys get hurt.
I think it's good for Pat, but I also think it's good for the offensive line and Pat to see kind of how that's going to work and get a feel for him, for them to get a feel for him, and likewise. So, and we've got some young guys that's why I left them in with Chad, so that they could get a little bit more extended work there. And really, all five of them, even though we've got two veterans on the left side, I mean, all five of them are new. So, well, you need to play, and that this gives us that opportunity.
I tell you, if the Chiefs had a brand new offensive line going into last year with no preseason games, I think you'd be pretty concerned about, hey, there's going to be a lot of miscommunication early in the season. Somebody could come free and just kill Mahomes, you know, just blast him and be out for the season or something. So luckily for the Chiefs, they do have 3 preseason games. I don't know what their plan is yet as what they're going to do on Friday when the Chiefs play the Vikings at 6 o'clock with pregame and 7 o'clock kickoff on Z96.3 at Lake, your home for the Chiefs in North Central Kansas. I don't know what the plan's going to be. I would imagine Mahomes is not going to play very much, if at all. But in regards to the offensive line, you almost wonder if they're going to play some, if not at least a quarter, coming up on Friday against the Vikings. Now remember, with the shortened preseason, we have 17 regular season games and only 3 preseason games. So there's an extra regular season game, first time we've ever had 17 regular season games. And so you do have over 2 weeks between the last preseason game and your regular season opener, which is at home, so the Chiefs don't have to travel, when they host the Browns on September the 12th at 3:25. So perhaps knowing that as well, Andy Reid could say, all right, if we get some guys a little nicked up, we got time to get them ready to go on September the 12th. Or maybe the philosophy will be, you know, we've got enough snaps. We got so many snaps with the first string on Friday against Arizona that we don't need to play any of these guys coming up on Friday against Minnesota. I don't know which way Andy Reid's going to go. Something tells me that this offensive line, he still feels needs some more work. And so I think that they probably will play on Friday. I just wonder if Chad Henne is going to be the starting quarterback Friday and he won't see Patrick Mahomes. And I don't think a lot of Chiefs fans would be upset if Mahomes doesn't play on Friday night, so he gets ready for the season opener. But let's be honest, Mahomes hasn't exactly looked super sharp. Last game Friday, him and Mecole Hardman were not on the same page. That's another thing you could work on if you had these guys play some on Friday against Minnesota. Some people say you're playing with fire because, you know, if Mahomes tweaks an ankle or another turf toe or takes one shot or scrambles and takes a hit. And that's all true. That's all true. So we'll see how Andy Reid handles the last preseason game. Typically in the past, what Andy Reid has done is he doesn't play his starters at all. Hardly anybody that's a starter plays the final preseason game. This year might be a little bit different because they have five, count them, five brand new starters on offensive line. All five are new. Completely turned over the offensive line from a year ago when they went to the Super Bowl. We talked yesterday about the under-the-radar moves the Chiefs made this offseason, and it'd be interesting to get Dusty's opinion on this, and maybe we can do this tomorrow. But there are four that I listed yesterday on the show. If you missed the show yesterday, we talked so much about Joe Tooney being a free agent pickup. We talked so much about Orlando Brown being a big trade. But there are moves the Chiefs have made this offseason that usually are the difference between winning a Super Bowl and not going to the Super Bowl or winning a Super Bowl. And Dusty, I want to present these to you. Dusty's back in here, and we're going to wrap up the show with this. I just said that Joe Tooney was obviously a marquee pickup. Clearly, Orlando Brown was a marquee pickup. But the Chiefs made other moves.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is the biggest under-the-radar move the Chiefs made this offseason that maybe isn't getting enough attention? Who's one of the newest members of the Chiefs that you think can really contribute and really make this team better, whether it's on offense or defense? What is it under, or maybe there's a couple you have that are under-the-radar moves that you like based on what you've seen so far this preseason?
I said Jerick McKinnon would be on my list of guys, I feel like.
I have four on my list, and that's one of them.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of all of them in my head.
Sure.
But he's the one that's kind of stood out. I didn't even get to watch the second preseason game, so I haven't had a lot of that stand out.
He had three catches, 21 yards, touchdown catch on a swing pass, and he was three carries for 4 yards. So nothing phenomenal, but he does have a burst. He is experienced. And he also plays special teams.
Return kicks, too. And
He didn't really.
He did that in the first game. I don't know if he did any of that second game.
He did in the second game.
Yeah.
But he did. He was on special teams, had a couple really good blocks, too, by the way. I agree. That's one of them. I don't think that's the biggest under the radar move they've made this season, offseason, but I do agree. It's on my list of four. Can you think of another one?
Reed.
Jerron Reed is maybe the biggest.
Yeah.
Because now you allow Chris Jones to play defensive end. And if Chris Jones has a big year at defensive end, and doesn't have to play much D-tackle, and Jerron Reed can do what he's capable of doing, that's going to be maybe the most valuable pickup they had all offseason. Maybe not Orlando Brown.
Yeah.
So I think that's a and he's 28, and they didn't have to pay him tons of money. I thought that was a great pickup. That's under the radar, although that's becoming more above the radar now. More people are talking about it. Right.
Yeah.
But there's two more that I have on my list, and one probably people aren't going to think much about, but one that I think if you've been watching preseason games, you're going to agree with me. Can you think of another one? An under-the-radar move the Chiefs made this offseason, whether it's bringing a guy in as a free agent or they traded for. I'll give you a clue. He's on defense.
Yeah, my mind is blank right now for some reason.
I like the Mike Hughes pickup.
Yeah.
All they did was swap a seventh for a sixth
for a guy
next
year.
Who was a first-round pick who they almost drafted in the first round in 2018.
Yeah.
And the thing holding him back has not been attitude. It's been injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy is healthy, and he also can help you in the punt return game. I'd rather have him back there than DeMarcus Robinson, for crying out loud. By the way, can we just cut DeMarcus Robinson? Every time he catches the ball, he goes backwards or sideways. Just get the ball, put your foot in the ground, and go forward, dude. He makes me so nervous every time he touches the ball. Saw it again on Friday. Dances five steps before doing anything. That's what I see when kids play flag football in first and second grade. So I'm not a big DeMarcus Robinson fan, and I'm glad Pringle's above on the depth chart, and he should be. But Mike Hughes can help them in the return game. And you look at the Chiefs' defense at cornerback right now. Ladarius Sneed looks like the real deal. Jarvarius Ward is still a solid corner in this league, and he's not over the hill. Younger guy. Which was a good trade, by the way. Remember, they get Parker Inger for him for the Cowboys. That ended up being a good trade by Brett Veach.
Absolutely, it did.
So you've got Sneed, you've got Ward, and now Mike Hughes looks like a bona fide. I mean, he's a first round pick that could be a starting corner. And in this league, you need three really good corners to be a good defense, probably because everybody likes to pass it. And Rashad Fenton's no slouch. He can play. He can play slot corner or whatever. And Tyrann Mathieu can play DB. He's versatile. He can play DB or safety. Even as a linebacker sometimes. I like how this secondary is coming together for the Chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's somebody I left out that's another guy that was a first-round pick, high pick, was DeAndre Baker, who was let go of the Giants because there was false allegations against him off the field. Giants ran from it. And the Chiefs picked him up on the cheap, and he looked really good before he broke his leg in the final regular season game last year. And the other night, he looked fairly good. And so if you got DeAndre Baker, who you got for nothing, you picked up Mike Hughes and hardly gave up anything there. You just swapped draft picks one round for next year, so it didn't affect you this year in the draft. And you've got Snead and you got Ward. Suddenly, you got four pretty doggone good corners compared to the year the Chiefs won the Super Bowl. You only had two, and you're wondering what happens if Breland gets hurt. You know? I mean, this Chiefs defense, when you start looking at it, if Jerron Reed can play like he's been playing, and they like what he's done, and Nadi inside, now Chris Jones on the edge, who looks like he likes that spot, and forget if Frank Clark's healthy or suspended. I think you can, you know, fill it with Okafor or Mike Dana. You got guys that can fill in. And if Clark comes back and can play, if you got to double team Chris Jones on one side, suddenly Frank Clark might have a better year. So I like the trickle down effect, the positivity with Jerron Reed inside, with Jones going to a D end, and he's 20 pounds leaner. He's been doing yoga, been studying tape. I think he could have a gigantic year. He's had a sack in each preseason game. But you get him in the DN, now suddenly it might make things easier for Clark on the other end to contend with. And now you might go back to the days of Derek Thomas and Neil Smith. Remember, those were good days. And then your secondary looks to safety. Thornhill looks a lot better. Great pick the other night. He's feeling better on that torn ACL knee, surgically repaired knee. So if he's back the way he was as a rookie, now you got a ball hawk in the secondary. You got Sorensen, and you've got, of course, Tyrann Mathieu. The only place you have to really wonder is back to where I've said all along, linebacker. And Hitchens, if he stays healthy and has a full year, he's a solid dude. So now you really just got to have a guy to plug in at that other linebacker spot, because a lot of times you're only going to play two backers anyway in this league, and that's going to be either Nick Bolton or Willie Gay. So, because I don't really feel great about Ben Neiman. But Nick Bolton has shown some flashes. Willie Gay, I don't think you can really fully count on. But if you look at this football team right now, if you believe the offensive line is improved, there's only one weakness this team has. And that's linebacker. Because, and even at running back, as you mentioned, you've got Hilaire. Okay, you got Darrell Williams, who came on at the end of last year. The reason you probably got rid of Damian Williams was the money, and also the fact that Darrell Williams you feel comfortable with. You brought in Jerick McKinnon. If Hilaire gets hurt and he banged up his ankle the other night, McKinnon is a guy that can play in this offense, clearly, can catch and he can run, and Williams can be a short yardage back. And we know the Chiefs don't have to rely on the run all the time. We know that. So they got insurance there. And there's one more. I give you three. Here's a fourth one that is very under the radar, and that's bringing Blake Bell back. Blake Bell is a gigantic improvement over Nick Kizer. Blake Bell's not the greatest pass-catching tight end. You don't need him to be. But he can be your second blocking tight end. He knows the system well. He can catch the ball here and there. And he buys time to develop Noah Gray, your fourth-round draft pick out of Duke, so he doesn't have to be rushed into playing time early. You know? I like those four moves the Chiefs made, and all four of them are under the radar. And so while we get all riled up about Orlando Brown, and rightfully so, and that's great, and Joe Tooney, and then we talk about the rookies that they drafted, and there's all this focus on the offensive line, very quietly, Brett Veach, I think, has done a wonderful job based on the money and the cap he had to deal with and giving guys long-term deals and lots of money. He's quietly brought in a 28-year-old defensive tackle, two very young defensive backs going back to DeAndre Baker last year, and then Mike Hughes this year, that are first-round talents, that are young. Blake Bell is a nice, serviceable, probably bridge gap tight end for, you know, Noah Gray down the line. And McKinnon is nice insurance at running back. He's experienced, and his knock is he's hurt. Well, if he doesn't play as much, he's less likely to get hurt. He could be a nice third down back in passing situations, possibly. He can pass protect, too. He did a nice job in blitz pickup the other night. So those four or five players they picked up, going back to even last year with DeAndre Baker, those all are very low-level pickups that didn't cost the Chiefs a ton of money. And how many times do you hear when a team wins a Super Bowl or a team wins the NBA title or a team wins the World Series, how many times do you hear the manager and the owner talk about, or the GM, about the moves they made that people didn't talk about? At the trade deadline, we got two superstars, and Trey Turner and Max Scherzer. But the Dodgers might have picked up a guy that's a utility guy and ends up being a hero in the playoffs. Remember a guy named, Remember a guy named Daniel Murphy that the Mets picked up and just went nuts? I mean, sometimes the best moves aren't the ones people think are high profile. It's other little moves. You know, everybody got caught up in the Johnny Cueto move. I remember at the time we said Zobrist was the better fit. And it ended up being right. So sometimes it's not the high profile move you make that helps your team get over the hump. It's a combination of smaller moves that can be the difference between making the Super Bowl and winning it and not making it or losing it. And I think, and the other thing, you got depth on the offensive line. Picking up a Kyle Long who may or may not make this team, but let's say he does, that may pay dividends in week 12.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? So I just love what the Chiefs have done. The question now is going to be what they do with Tyrann Mathieu, which we've spent a lot of time on that already. But, I mean, do you like those moves? Is there anything? Is there a move I missed that the Chiefs have done and made?
Well, obviously, it took me a while to come up with the ones that we did.
Sure.
There's obviously always you're going to look at draft picks and things like that. But as far as free agency and trades, I can't think of anybody else. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that mm-hmm. one is going to make the difference here. And I mean, you don't know that until you actually get out into the games. But from what we see right now, it does look like some of those guys are obviously they're upgrades for backups. You know, they needed a corner with Bashaud Breeland not re-signing. You know, they don't have him anymore,
mm-hmm.
and so you get Hughes, and last year you get Baker, and you
get younger,
and they're absolutely younger. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I mean, those are the kind of moves you need to make to create depth and keep everything to where there's not a drop-off when somebody gets hurt or suspended even or something like that.
DeAndre Baker was a first-round draft pick in 2019 as a corner by the Giants. He's on this team. He's 23. Mike Hughes was a first-round pick of the Vikings in 2018, and he is all of 24.
He just
turned 24 in February. So think about this for a second, and I don't know their contract situations. I would guess, well, Hughes would be on that rookie deal coming over in that situation.
Baker might be his last year, his situation too.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, the point being is you got some two cheap guys on rookie deals, in essence, that are first-round talents that you got for nothing.
Yeah.
And the whole key is whether they stay healthy. And if they both stay healthy, you got steals. Once again, the biggest word in the English dictionary. If.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or sunflowerstateradio.com.